Our guest today is one of the most influential politicians in New England. Let us meet our state treasurer, Deb Goldberg, in this special edition of Chai with Manju at the State House in Boston. So thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
And so my first question for you is, when you became the state treasurer, you said that you will be a treasurer who invests in people. Can you explain that, and do you think you've achieved your goal?
Well, we will never completely achieve our goals until we have touched every single person's life. So I have a big agenda for myself. But yes, one of the reasons I ran for treasurer is my focus on assuring economic stability and economic opportunity for everyone. And we do that here in this treasurer's office in very unique ways. Mm-hmm. Yes, we manage tax dollars prudently, and we issue debt so that we can fund important projects across the state. Mm-hmm. We make sure that the pension fund is doing well so that elderly people who are retirees can count on getting that check every month, and they've earned it over time. But a very unique thing that we did is we created the Office of Economic Empowerment, the first of its kind in the country, focused on issues that would directly impact every person's life throughout the Commonwealth. And that is ensuring that everyone has access to the financial knowledge and financial skills they need to survive and succeed in this state and in their lives, through financial literacy and financial education programs. And we created a task force that will actually be issuing its report almost momentarily. We've had a statewide wage equality group that has come together. We've had six roundtables throughout the state that will then develop a toolkit and an online presence that assist businesses in how they get to the bottom of the cultural issues and the long-term things that have prevented women and their families having the economic stability that they deserve and they need. It's about empowering people to empower themselves, and that's what I mean by investing in people.
That's wonderful. So I read that your great-great-grandmother opened a small grocery store in North End, and she lived above the store with 11 children. Eventually, of course, that led to the giant Stop and Shop today.
Yes.
And you worked as a retail clerk and then as in the executive position in the store. What are some of the values that you grew up with and which influenced you?
Well, you see, that's really why there's such incredible continuity from what I'm doing this very day to all the way back to, her name was Yenta Rabinovitz. And in fact, when I announced that I was running for treasurer, we announced on the very spot that she arrived in front of the store that is still there, which is now Bova Bakery in the North End. And the reason why I wanted to do it there, and my parents, my children were there, was because it is those values that drive me. It wasn't about building a business, a profitable business. It was about creating employment, about jobs for each and every child and all of their friends and relatives that arrived in this country. It was about taking that whole idea and creating opportunities for one, two, three generations at a time. And it was true. Three generations of families, immigrant families, worked at Stop and Shop. I still have people who come up to me and say, my grandfather worked there, my dad worked there, I put myself through school working there. And so that was what it was about. It was about shared economic opportunity and stability. Those are the very values that drive me in this office. And so there's a direct connection to my great-great-grandmother.
Mm-hmm. How did you first get interested in politics?
Well, my mother likes to say it was my dad,
okay.
But I have to say that the values, and it was her great, you know, her great grandmother, that those values drive you into public service. But technically, Stop and Shop went through something called a hostile takeover in 1988, which meant that we didn't voluntarily sell the business. It was literally taken away from us.
Okay.
I would be working there today if it were not for that, making sure that 50,000 people had jobs they could count on and good benefits. Mm-hmm. But because that occurred, mm-hmm. I then said, well, then I want to focus on public service. And a lot of very interesting women encouraged me to run for office.
Can you name some of them?
Evelyn Murphy, the former lieutenant governor, and also the author of the book, Getting Even, which is about wage equality and pay equity. Former state senator Lois Pines from Newton. And my dad had been involved in town politics. Even though he was working full-time and working his way up at Stop and Shop, he was a town meeting member for years. Then he ran town-wide and not only won, but if you added his three opponents' votes together, he beat all three of them, if you merged them. So he had me then at 7 years old as Michael Dukakis' mascot, not when he was running for governor or president, but when he was running for state representative from Brookline. So I really was a political activist from a very young age. And so I ran for town meeting, and within several months, people said, you need to run for selectman. I ran for selectman and fortunately won, and then became chairman of the Board of Selectmen when people encouraged me to be looking at statewide office.
Now, one of the causes that you mentioned also, and that is very close to your heart, is the wage equality for women. And Massachusetts Equal Pay Act was passed in 1945, but there is still a huge discrepancy in pay. Why do you think that's so? And as a state treasurer, what have you done to bridge that gap?
So, Equal Pay Acts have been passed all over the country and in the federal government. That doesn't mean that the paradigm has changed. And when I mentioned Evelyn Murphy in the book she wrote, and she wrote that as a Brandeis fellow, what she did is she dug under to try to figure out what is keeping women from getting paid what they should be. And in Massachusetts today, we're a little bit better, but then again, we have one of the highest educated women populations in the country. So in total, we're 82 cents on the dollar. But African-American women in Massachusetts are 62 cents on the dollar. Latina women, 50 cents on the dollar in Massachusetts. And we look at what are the causes, but then how have they become institutionalized? That they become institutionalized cultural barriers. So Evelyn did the research, she identified the issues, and then she wrote the how to get it done. And for me, it is important, of course, to pass laws, but it's more important to get to the heart of the problem and change it. So from the moment I was elected, even before I was sworn in every hiring decision that we had, we looked at who was the most qualified and paid them what we were worth. We also encouraged women and people of color to apply to this office because they would be valued and viewed completely equally to anyone else, and that there was enormous opportunity. But I think a very, very important focus was who was to become our human resource managers, who was going to be our head of human resource, who was going to be our head of human resource at the lottery, at the Mass School Building Authority. What were they doing over at the pension fund? And how did we get management to understand that it is their job to assure that people are paid properly, that it is their job to look at resumes in light of real skills, not whether you were able to stay in a job for X amount of years, and then what could we do internally to create a more family-supportive, family-friendly environment. So we did things right away, like, for example, 12-week paid parental leave. Now, that is for families. And I do have men who are taking the paid parental leave. But often where women get impacted by wage discrepancies is if they have to take any time to take care of a baby or a newborn. So right away, that made an equal playing field for the women in the organization.
So I want to ask you something which is very close to the Indian community. You were our special guest at Saheli fundraiser. I have never seen such a warm welcome to any politicians. People won't leave you alone. So how did you get interested in minority communities, and have you followed the growing Indian American community here?
Well, I again, you know, I'm going to sound like I'm repeating myself. I believe the way I was brought up was very influential on who I am. And I was brought up with several different ways of looking at the world. One was that we are all the same, but some people don't get the same opportunities. And that sometimes people are viewed through a lens that they have nothing, should not have any impact on who they are. And when I was about 3 years old, I was somewhere with a wonderful woman who was helping take care of me because my mother worked full time. She was president of Stop and Shop. And somebody said something about her color. And I went home and I said to my dad, is Lil colored and I'm white? And he put me up next to our refrigerator and he said, what color is the refrigerator? And I said, white. And he said, what color are you? And I looked at my hand and that was it. It was a magical moment. And I remember to this day, he and I talked about this a couple weeks ago because somebody asked me to repeat that story. And I think that I'd never changed. It was the way I was brought up. It was the way I was brought up to treat people, to understand people. But in particular for the Asian and South Pacific Rim communities, I developed some sort of intuitive understanding, initially with the Chinese community because I grew up in Brookline and they also migrated to Brookline along with the Jewish community. But understanding that in particular the women culturally were not as encouraged to step out. And so because I was being mentored by my own mother to step out, I recognized that all women needed to do that, but that certain cultures inhibit that. And so, of course, because I like to mentor, I really identified and began to support other communities.
Now, talking of mentoring, you have been involved with young people a lot. You've been a big supporter of the STEM project. Then Scholars and Sense Financial Fair was held by you. So tell us a little bit about how did you get interested in such projects?
Sure. So we have a job study that shows that the future is obviously in STEM-related fields and not just math, but financial services. And that minorities and women are underrepresented in those fields. And those are where the good paying jobs are in Massachusetts. So how are you creating economic opportunity for everyone if you are not opening those fields and mentoring people to go into those fields? And so it comes right back to the basics. How was I brought up? To create economic stability for people. It's right back to the food business. We nourish people.
Margaret Thatcher used to say that too.
Ah, yes. Interesting.
So you are the chairperson of Adoptions with Love.
Correct.
So tell us something about that.
Well, both of my children are adopted.
Okay.
And I initially adopted them through the agency, which is Adoptions with Love.
Okay.
After it was begun by a founder who is no longer living. And she asked me to go on the board at the time that she was still alive. When she was getting very ill, she felt that the agency should be closed because she was a classic entrepreneur. She worked more than 24/7, and it may have led to her not being well. And so we were going to do that when the social workers who worked there came to me and said, we really want to give it a go. But they had no business background at all. And adoption is a very, it's very tough work. It is very unpredictable. But I agreed to become the acting executive director at the time because we were all so passionate about taking care of the birth mothers, helping them make a decision whether they could parent and we would give them skills to parent or whether they wanted to place their children. And then, of course, it resulted in families. And very emotional. That it means a lot. I adore my children. They are fantastic. Uh-huh. Of course they are.
How old are they?
They're 25 and 23 now, and they're great. And so I became acting executive director. We brought in a very professional board. We brought in a nonprofit consultant. We set up the business model, and we continue to thrive to this day. The good news is that I'm head of the board, but we have now the executive director and the deputy executive director.
The business school with a heart.
Yes.
So let's talk a little bit about your family. So we get to know you better. And you're married to Michael Winter.
Yes.
Right? So tell us something about him, and what was it about him that you knew that he was the right
one? So my husband is an immigrant. He came to this country when he was 12 years old. English is his third language. And they were brought here by a nonprofit agency. So when they arrived in Dorchester in 1958, they had nothing. And he had to work hard. And in that era, there were no English as a second language. You ended up on the street, and whatever you learned, you learned. And so I think the thing that really attracted me to Michael was that I knew that no matter what, he could survive. They had been through challenges that required survival. And, you know, we always have to be aware that the world can turn on its head. I mean, sadly, look what happened in Paris on Friday night. The world can turn on its head. And I knew that he would be a hardworking person and someone who could take care of his family no matter what. And I believe that was the most important thing that I saw in him when I met him.
Now, you're a big supporter of strong women, supporting Hillary Clinton.
I am.
Do you have any plans to run for any other office yourself? I know we had suggested that when you came for our office.
You know, as I talk about the treasurer's office, you see this is a really exciting place.
Very exciting.
On any given day, you can go from talking about the lottery, whose mission is to get money back to every city and town in the state, while also supporting small retailers who sell the lottery ticket. You talk about the Maskell Building Authority. We talk about wage equality. We talk about financial literacy, debt management, cash management. It's a very exciting job. And so my goal, and I was asked this at a National Association of State Treasurers meeting where I was a plenary speaker. They said, what do you hope to achieve? And my goal is huge. I want to make sure that every child, every adult, everyone in Massachusetts has the financial skills they need to survive, and that they aren't harmed by a subprime mortgage crisis or by onerous debt and not knowing what they were getting into. So in order to achieve that goal, I have to spend a lot of time here to get that job done. And I am a doer. It's not just talking about it in the abstract, but it's the day-to-day of getting it done. And I think that gets right back to my roots again. My grandfather was in the stores till he was so weak from cancer that he couldn't go any longer. And so that's who we are. And I don't think about running for other office while I'm so excited and so engaged in this job.
You're not only a doer, you're very charismatic.
Thank you.
Okay, so because my producer's question for you was, what is it like as a Democrat to work for a Republican governor?
Well, the exciting thing is we work alongside each other, so we collaborate. And I don't view my role as partisan, even though I am a Democrat. I view my role as exactly what I said. This is the job. We're creating economic opportunity. We are creating stability. We are creating revenues to go back that pay for snow plowing, school nurses. You know, I am so focused on that, and that's not partisan. I don't say to the towns, well, you can only give it to the Democrats in the neighborhood. So I believe that the governor and I have the same goals in terms of what we want for the state, and so we collaborate on the issues that involve both of us.
So now that brings me to the last part of the interview, which is called a rapid response.
Uh-oh.
You know, I'm a physician, so Whatever comes to your head.
Okay.
The first thing, what do you think is your biggest strength?
My biggest strength? Passion.
Passion.
That and commitment. Okay.
And what do you think is your biggest weakness?
I am extremely hands-on and detail-oriented. Ask anyone who works in this office, there isn't one thing that can go out without me editing it. And I get that from my father, not my mother. And he would, after I edited it, if we were to send it to him, he'd re-edit it.
Is it a little micromanagement?
Little micromanagement.
I've been accused of, and you have a great memory.
Yes,
I have seen that. And who do you think, who would you call was your mentor, do you think?
Well, you know, that really has to be my mother. How many people had a mother who was one of the top 10 businesswomen in America in Fortune magazine in the 1970s? And when I was a kid, and it didn't seem possible that I could ever be her, she gave me the book Jonathan Livingston Seagull.
Okay.
And in it she wrote, I hope someday you'll join me, meaning fly, which is the story book is about a seagull learning to fly. And I, at the time I cried. But what she was trying to instill in me was the understanding that I could do anything. And she also always told me she wanted me to do what made me happy. So it wasn't that I had to be her, but that the goal was for me to find a passion and a dream and fly. And so I have to say, it was my mom, although my dad really mentored me in the political world. I told you she blames him.
Yes. Now, do you have any favorite movie?
I tried to think of what would be a favorite movie, and nothing really struck me.
Okay.
So I loved going to the movies, but I actually get more excited about television series like Homeland. Or in the old way back years ago, Dallas. And those kind of and Dynasty. Yes, I like Dynasty too.
What is the one fun thing about you that people don't know? Because I know you have a great sense of humor.
I am a great dancer. I am.
Okay.
I am.
What kind of dancing?
Everything.
Really?
In fact, even with my broken foot, I was dancing to country and western on one foot.
You have to come see her Bollywood dancing then.
I do. I absolutely do.
Okay. I love that quote, well-behaved women rarely make history. So what do you have to say about that?
My mother gave that to me.
Oh, really?
Really. So what does that say about my mentoring even today?
And also sense of humor runs in the family.
Yes. you know what? You have to take risks. And it's much harder for women to take risks. And you have to be able to do it in a way that asserts yourself without, you have to be sensitive to the fact that men aren't as receptive to assertiveness in women as they are in each other. And so you don't want to, you want to find a style where you can achieve things without causing people to bristle. And I learned that from my mother too. I used to watch her in meetings and how she handled herself and how she got the job done. But at the same time, when one has to really step up and really take a stand, you cannot be afraid to do so. And I've done that too.
To be feminine and to be assertive.
And then if you have to take it to the next level, when someone doesn't respond to the appropriate approach, then to be able to take it to the next level when you have to get it done.
Absolutely. What's your favorite hobby?
I think it's going to Red Sox games. I'll go to three games in a row where the Yankees beat the Red Sox, all three games, and you cannot get me to leave till the last ball is pitched and the last out is struck. I am a diehard.
Okay. Now, are you a traveler?
I am.
You are.
Of course, this job doesn't allow as much as what I love. I am the tourist of the world. Mm-hmm. I have to read everything on where I'm going. I have to know everything. I have to even memorize the street maps. I have to find out what all the restaurants are. I research. I buy books. I go online. And then when I'm there, I'm so excited.
And you're a risk taker, because I saw you just take over the most spiciest Indian food and just try it without thinking.
Well, I love to eat. That could be another hobby, eating.
What is your favorite quotation? Is there anything, a favorite quotation that you like that has influenced you?
I think that I jump around, but I typically quote other people. Mm-hmm. If somebody says something that I think is remarkable, we had a wage equality roundtable here in Boston, and I thought that Jim Rooney said the most important thing of the entire, well, one of the most important things. We had an incredible roundtable. He said, if you want to know what a woman wants, just ask her. Isn't that a kind of quote?
I'm going to borrow that too.
Exactly. I thought, what could be more simple? Everyone, you know, you could study what women at work want. You could study this. You could ask a lot of men what they thought the women at work want. Just ask them. They'll tell you flex time, being able to leave to pick up my kids in school, being given credit from working at home. One of the things that a lot of men managers don't understand is women work 24/7.
And I have interviewed so many people and so many couples, and the one thing all women say is that he needs to listen.
Ha. But they have no ears.
He needs to hear. Now, where do you see yourself in 5 years or after this job?
Oh, I see myself still here in 5 years. So this isn't after this job.
Okay. Then after this job.
I see myself doing this for a long period of time, please God. I think the driving force in my life always will be, am I doing something positive for others? I derive the most intrinsic reward from positively impacting people's lives. And so I suspect that as long as I can in the work that I do, it will be focused on where I can make a difference.
On that note, thank you so much.
Thank you for coming.
Appreciate your time.